So, imagine you're reading a history book about the Battle of Gettysburg, and the author is describing the hills, the July heat, and the specific troop movements in this just excruciating detail.
Right, really painting a picture.
Exactly.
Right.
But they deliberately leave out one tiny fact. They don't mention that it happened right in the middle of the American Civil War.
Wow. Yeah, that would be, I mean, that's a pretty massive omission.
Right. You'd understand the topography and the weather perfectly, but you would miss the entire point of the battle. And surprisingly, that is exactly how most people read ancient texts today. So, welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive into Dr. Stephen D. Matthewson's teachings on Old Testament narratives.
Yeah, specifically, we're looking at session five, which is his overview of the exegetical process.
Yes, and our mission for you, the listener, is to hand you a completely different lens for reading these ancient texts. We're moving way past just, memorizing isolated names and dates. We're stepping into the intricate layered mechanics of how these stories were actually constructed to send a message.
Which is just a crucial skill. Because whether you are reading biblical literature or analyzing historical documents, or honestly just trying to be a sharper consumer of modern news, understanding what we call setting changes everything.
It really does.
Yeah, learning how to extract a true big idea from a text fundamentally changes how you process information. You stop looking at isolated facts and you start seeing the architectural design behind the message.
Okay, let's unpack this because the method we are exploring today hinges on a specific acronym used for narrative analysis, and it's ACTS. ACTS.
Right, so A stands for action or the plot. C is for characters. T is for tech, the dialogue.
And the final piece, which is our focus today, is the S setting. Now, when I hear the word setting, my mind defaults to, scenery. I picture a desert, a throne room, maybe a mountain. But the premise here is that setting is far more than just a physical backdrop.
Oh, absolutely. Scenery is just the surface. Setting actually operates on two distinct dimensions. First, you have the historical and cultural setting, which is the physical place and time. But second, and often, well, more importantly, you have the literary setting.
Which brings us back to Matthewson's Gettysburg analogy because it perfectly illustrates this dual layer. Let's expand on that.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, setting number one is the physical reality. It's July 1st through the 3rd, 1863. You have the Union and Confederate forces converging on this small Pennsylvania town. You have the literal dirt of Cemetery Ridge, Little Round Top, and Devil's Den. That is the physical ground.
Right, the geography. But then setting number two is its place on the timeline. It sits squarely in the middle of the 1861 to 1865 war.
Exactly. And after the Union victory, General George Meade failed to pursue Robert E. Lee's retreating army.
Yeah, and because of that specific placement in the sequence of events, Lee recouped and the war dragged on for 2 more years.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, if you try to analyze Gettysburg just by looking at the elevation of Little Round Top, you're missing half the story.
You really are. You have to know where the event is positioned within the wider conflict. And ancient narratives function the exact same way. You cannot understand a text simply by charting the physical topography. You have to look at where the story sits in the larger literary flow of the document.
Okay, let's start with that first dimension, the historical and cultural stage. Because in the ancient world, physical details were rarely included just to, set a spooky mood. They carry immense symbolic weight.
They absolutely do. They aren't just filler.
Right. I look at the example from 2 Kings 1.9. The king's arrogant military officer demands that the prophet Elijah come down from his spot on top of a hill, and Elijah flatly refuses. Now, is this just the ancient equivalent of a modern CEO insisting on sitting at the head of a boardroom table to project dominance?
The power dynamic is identical, yeah. Our sources cite Robert Chisholm on this, and he points out that in this narrative, Elijah's elevated physical position literally manifests his spiritual authority.
Oh, wow. So the hill isn't just a hill.
Exactly. The king is demanding submission, but the physical setting communicates the underlying theology. Elijah, as the spokesman for the divine, literally holds the higher ground over earthly kings and their messengers. The physical setting is not just where the scene happens. The setting is the theme itself.
That structural approach completely reframes the Book of Ruth for me, too.
Yeah.
When you look at the geography and the cultural moment, the whole meaning shifts.
Oh, Ruth is a perfect example of this.
Right. So we are introduced to a man named Elimelech. And his name ironically translates to, "My God is King." Famine strikes, and he takes his family out of Israel, so he's leaving the covenant community, and relocates to Moab divine food.
Yeah, and the text gives us a very deliberate timestamp right in the first verse. It says, in the days when the judges ruled.
And that phrase is doing a massive amount of heavy lifting, isn't it?
Huge, because the era of the judges was notoriously brutal. It was characterized by moral decay and societal collapse. By marrying that cultural reality with the physical geography, the narrative exposes a deeper truth.
So a physical famine in the Promised Land wasn't just a weather event.
No, not at all. It was seen as a symptom of a spiritual drought. Elimelech, the guy whose very name proclaims God is king, abandons that king to seek a purely physical, pragmatic solution in Moab.
Wow. So it changes it from a story about a family just, you know, looking for groceries into a critique of spiritual abandonment.
Exactly. And we see this with seasons, too.
Oh, yeah. In 2 Kings 11 and 12, the famous lead up to the David and Bathsheba scandal, the writer casually notes that it is the springtime when kings typically go out to war.
Right. But where is David?
David stays behind in Jerusalem. It functions like a giant seasonal red flag waving in the background, subtly telling the reader, David is in the wrong place at the wrong time.
The author weaponizes the season to critique the character's dereliction of duty. That is the depth of the historical and cultural setting.
Which brings us to the second dimension, the literary setting. So if the historical setting is the where, the literary setting is the when in the text. Like, where did the author choose to place this specific narrative within the larger document?
Right. It's about structural placement.
I have to push back here before we dive into this, though, because when we start looking for these hidden sandwich meanings or deeper literary placements, aren't we risking massive confirmation bias? I mean, how do we know we aren't just projecting our own complex modern literary expectations onto ancient historians who were maybe simply trying to record events chronologically?
Well, it is a fair critique. You definitely always have to guard against seeing patterns in the clouds, so to speak. However, ancient New Eastern literature relied heavily on structure because it was primarily an oral culture.
Oh, so structure was how you preserved meaning.
Exactly. These authors often rearranged chronological events or juxtaposed specific stories deliberately to create theological commentary. The structures are simply too consistent and honestly too mathematically precise to be accidental.
Okay, let's test that. Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's look at Solomon in 1 Kings 3. We have the incredibly famous legal case of the two prostitutes claiming the same baby.
Right, the classic wisdom story.
Yeah. Solomon orders the baby to be cut in half with a sword. The real mother begs him to spare the child, and Solomon identifies her true maternal instinct. Now, on its own, it is a brilliant anecdote about jurisprudence.
But the literary placement is what gives it profound theological weight. You have to look at what happens right before it.
Right. That specific court case is placed immediately after the story of God coming to Solomon in a dream and granting him a wise and discerning heart.
So the baby story isn't just a random highlight drawn from Solomon's 40-year reign. By placing it directly after the dream, the text is structurally validating the previous chapter.
It provides immediate, undeniable proof that the divine gift of wisdom was actually imparted.
Exactly. The placement serves as the verification. But ancient writers didn't just use this literary sandwich effect to make their kings look good. They used it to expose their fatal flaws, too.
And that leads perfectly into 1 Samuel 25, the story of David and Nabal. This narrative is just wedged between two separate, highly dramatic occasions where David is being hunted by King Saul in the wilderness.
Right. And in both the preceding chapter and the following chapter, David has the perfect opportunity to assassinate Saul.
But he refuses, famously declaring he will not harm the Lord's anointed. He appears incredibly noble, practicing immense self-restraint.
Right. But right in the middle of those two high points of self-control, the author drops the story of Nabal.
Nabal is a wealthy, foolish landowner who casually insults David. And in response to this insult, David entirely loses his composure.
He completely snaps. He straps on his sword, rallies his men, and marches off fully intending to slaughter Nabal and his entire household.
It is only because Nabal's wife, Abigail, intercepts David and talks him down that a massacre is prevented. The contrast is jarring.
It really is. The placement is essentially arguing that it is remarkably easy for David to spare a powerful king when he is trying to prove his own righteousness, but it is nearly impossible for him to spare an annoying, ungrateful fool who bruises his ego.
Oh, wow. So the literary setting exposes the fragility of David's character.
Yeah, it forces you, the reader, to realize the future king is still deeply volatile. And the authors use the structural commentary to expose the flaws of entire family lines, not just individuals.
Like the deeply debated narrative in Genesis 38 focusing on Judah. In our source material, a British interpreter famously referred to Genesis 38 as a dog among nine pins.
I love that imagery.
It's great, right? Like an unruly dog running across a lawn and knocking over your bowling game. Because chapter 38 aggressively interrupts the sweeping, dramatic saga of Joseph.
Right. Joseph is betrayed by his brothers and sold into slavery.
Then, abruptly, the narrative cuts away to a full chapter detailing his brother Judah's disastrous and immoral sexual choices with his daughter-in-law Tamar. And then, in chapter 39, we cut right back to Joseph in Egypt. If you are reading chronologically, it just feels like a massive, clumsy delay.
But calling it a clumsy delay completely misses the genius of the literary setting. It is not an interruption. It is a deliberate foil.
Okay, explain that.
The author is using structure to create a stark moral contrast. In Genesis 39, we watch Joseph face severe sexual temptation from Potiphar's wife. He refuses her advances, maintaining his integrity at the cost of his own freedom.
But the chapter right before it, Genesis 38, shows Judah failing spectacularly under much less pressure.
Exactly, demonstrating a total lack of self-control. Yeah. It elevates Joseph's purity by framing it directly against Judah's corruption.
But the literary setting has an even longer game in mind, doesn't it?
It does. When you zoom out to the end of Genesis and the broader biblical narrative, you realize that it is Judah flawed, compromised, out of control Judah who is chosen as the bloodline for the eventual Messiah, not the seemingly flawless Joseph.
Wow. So the placement of chapter 38 forces the reader to confront the reality that divine grace often operates through the most broken, unlikely lineage.
The structure itself is teaching theology, and this doesn't just happen chapter to chapter. It happens across entire books. Look at the book of Judges.
Yeah, the downward spiral of the nation from chapter 3 to chapter 16 is incredibly grim, but the overarching structure of the book perfectly mirrors its own tragic ending.
Right. The introduction of Judges outlines two primary failures for Israel. First, the failure to drive out the Canaanites, which is the problem of war.
And that is immediately followed by falling into the worship of Canaanite gods, which is the problem of idols.
The author sets the trajectory. War leads to idolatry. But when you look at the harrowing conclusion of the book, chapters 17 through 21, the structure provides a tragic mirror image.
Scholars refer to this ending as the canonization of Israel, meaning Israel has become entirely indistinguishable from the pagan nations they were supposed to displace.
Yeah, the order flips. The ending starts with the problem of idolatry, but it has mutated into something much worse.
Right. Israelites are stealing idols from each other and setting up rogue priests. And that is followed by the problem of war, which is also mutated. Instead of fighting external Canaanite enemies, Israel is now engaged in a brutal, horrific civil war against its own tribes.
The narrative structure moving from external war and idols to internal idols and civil war mechanically demonstrates a society unspooling. The text isn't just telling you things got worse. The architecture of the book is demonstrating the collapse.
Which brings us to the ultimate goal of all this analysis. We have dissected the historical setting and the literary setting. We have looked at action, characters, and talking. But how do you take all these disparate elements and synthesize them? How do you distill the theological message into a single, cohesive thought?
Right. How do you find the big idea? This is the peg on which all the details of the story hang. But our sources make a very clear distinction between a topic and an idea.
And there is an anecdote about President Calvin Coolidge that perfectly illustrates the difference here. So Coolidge goes to church on a Sunday, returns to the White House, and his wife asks him what the sermon was about. Coolidge replies, sin.
Right.
She presses him for details, asking, well, what did the preacher say about it? And Coolidge deadpans, well, he was against it.
It is a great story because it highlights the trap readers constantly fall into. Sin is a topic. It tells you absolutely nothing about the specific message the author was trying to convey.
Right.
To formulate a true big idea, you need two specific functioning components, a subject and a complement.
Let's break those down functionally.
Okay, so the subject is the exact question the writer is addressing. It should always be framed as a who, what, why, when, where, or how question. For instance, why do humans continually choose to rebel?
Okay, got it.
The compliment is the answer to that question. And to be clear, we aren't talking about a compliment like telling someone they have a nice shirt. We mean compliment with an E, as in two things that complete each other. The compliment completes the thought by answering the subject question.
I want to test this framework on arguably the most famous scandal in these texts. David and Bathsheba from 7 Samuel 11 and 12. Most people read this story. You know, David on the roof, Bathsheba bathing, the resulting affair, the murder of her husband Uriah, and conclude the topic is, How to Avoid Adultery, or The Destructive Consequences of Lust.
Right, that's the standard reading.
But if we apply the subject and complement framework, does the underlying message actually change? Is the biblical writer really doing something more complex than that?
It changes dramatically. Paul Borden offers a great perspective on this in our sources. If you look closely at the underlying theology being communicated, the actual subject of the narrative isn't adultery. The subject the author is exploring is, what does David have to learn about responding to the grace of God?
Wait, so by reframing the subject that way, the entire center of gravity in the story shifts.
It absolutely does, because the complement, the answer the text provides to that question is this. David must learn to accept what the grace of God has given him, and just as importantly, he must accept what the grace of God is not.
That completely reframes the narrative, because when you read it through that lens, Uriah, the murdered husband, isn't just a tragic victim. Uriah becomes the baseline for what David was supposed to be.
Exactly. Uriah accepts his station, honors his commitments, and accepts what he has been given.
So David's root failure wasn't a sudden moment of biological lust. His root failure was a profound arrogance. He despised God by refusing to accept the boundaries of his own gifts. God had given him a kingdom, wealth, security, and multiple wives. But David looked at the one single thing outside his circle of gifts, Uriah's wife, and demanded it anyway.
God could have easily stripped the kingdom from David in that moment, but through the intense confrontation with the prophet Nathan, David is forced to confront his arrogance. He actually learns the lesson about grace and boundaries.
Wow.
Yeah. And the challenge for you, the reader, is taking this exegetical idea, which is strictly about an ancient king named David, and translating it into a timeless homiletical principle for your own life today.
Because, you know, I don't rule a kingdom, and I can't deploy an army to cover up my mistakes.
Precisely. The timeless translation links directly to the ancient commandment against coveting. Coveting is not just wanting something nice. It is a fundamental discontentment. It is desiring what you do not have and insisting that you deserve it.
Right.
The timeless big idea is that we, too, must learn to gratefully accept what the grace of God has provided us and respect the boundaries of what it has not.
That is a much sharper, more difficult lesson than a basic morality tale about lust. But finding that clean subject and complement sounds great in a textbook. In reality, some of these texts are incredibly dense and confusing.
Oh, absolutely. They aren't all easy to crack. Matthewson uses an analogy about living in Montana and splitting firewood. He notes that sometimes you swing the axe, the wood splits perfectly down the middle, and you feel incredibly accomplished. But other times, you hit a stubborn knot in the wood. The axe bounces off, your hands sting, and you are just stuck. So what is the mechanism for cutting through a textual knot?
What's fascinating here is that when you hit a knot in firewood, you can't just swing harder. You have to step back, examine the block, and find the natural grain of the wood. And in these ancient narratives, the grain is located at the intersection of two specific forces.
All right, what are they?
Haddon Robinson offers two specific clues. When you are stuck trying to find the big idea, you need to look for these. Number one, what is the vision of God in this story? Like, what specific aspect of the divine character is being highlighted?
So in the story of David and Goliath in 1 Samuel 17, vision of God is his life-giving power protecting his people against an impossible threat. But in the David and Bathsheba text we just discussed, the prophet Nathan confronts David by listing off a massive inventory of everything God had handed to him. The vision of God in that moment is God as the ultimate generous giver of gifts.
Right. So you identify that divine character trait first. Then you look for the second clue, which scholars like Brian Chappell refer to as the depravity factor or the fallen condition focus.
The depravity factor.
Yeah. You ask the text, what is the specific human flaw, rebellion, or temptation in this story that is actively fighting against that specific vision of God?
Oh, I see. So to find the grain of the wood in the Bathsheba story, the vision of God is the generous giver of vast gifts. The depravity factor is David's toxic discontentment, his tendency to despise the giver by obsessing over the one thing he wasn't given.
Exactly. When you identify the character of God in the narrative and map it directly against the specific human flaw resisting it, you align your analytical axe with the natural grain of the text.
And the knot disappears.
Right. The big idea splits wide open and the subject and complement become obvious.
We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We moved from understanding how physical hills and seasonal weather function as theological commentary in the historical setting.
Yeah, looking past the scenery.
Right. And then we challenge the idea of confirmation bias to reveal the deliberate, profound sandwich placements of the literary setting. And finally, we learned how to align the vision of God with the depravity factor to forge clear subject and complement, cracking open the big idea of a text.
And the ultimate takeaway for you, the listener, is that this framework is not reserved for ancient historians or theologians. This is a masterclass in deep reading comprehension.
It really is.
Whenever you were consuming information, a biography, a long-form article, or an ancient narrative, force yourself to ask, what is the true setting here? And what is the actual big idea answering a specific question rather than just a broad, generic topic?
It changes how you process the world. And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over on your own. Apply this framework to your own life right now. Think about the depravity factor and the vision of God you're experiencing this week. If the story of your current week was sandwiched between two other chapters of your life, just like David's fragile moment with Nabal was sandwiched between his moments of great restraint, what would that literary setting reveal about the true big idea of your daily choices?